This scene had the same uncanny strangeness to it. Sprawled in a camp chair like a bored queen receiving guests was Carr Pole. She lifted her hand in greeting to Stike, the other propped under her chin as she gazed at the Dragoon commander. Stike put away his knife and gestured for Jackal to do the same.
"I thought you were going to come for me this morning."
Stike nearly jumped out of his skin. The words came from the mouth of the commander, but they were spoken in perfect Adran, and in a voice that did not belong to a burly, war-weary Dragoon officer. The tone was soft-spoken, the voice a gentle soprano with a hint of a laugh to it. He looked at Carr Pole, who hadn't moved except to adopt a rather smug smile. He pointed at the officer. "Is that you?" Carr Pole nodded. Stike forced himself to relax. He walked down the line of frozen officers, leaning over to feel the soft breath coming from their lips and wave a hand in front of their eyes. He even pushed one over, watching him topple like a statue and remain cross-legged without so much as a flinch. Stike finished his examination by walking around the Dragoon commander, examining her flushed face. Upon this closer look, he found her just as frozen as her men, except the eyes. They stared straight ahead, but there was life in them, and if he was forced to guess, he would say that she was still there under the surface. Stike wondered at this show of power. He'd been told that Carr Pole was more powerful than her fellow Bone Eyes by several orders of magnitude, but that she was unpracticed. Could an enemy Bone Eye do this to Stike? Could she do this to Stike? The answer to that second question was an obvious yes, and it made Stike's skin crawl. He considered what Giotz had told him earlier this week, likening the sorcery of a Bone Eye to rape. The thought, and all these frozen faces, made Stike uncomfortable. Jackal still stood outside the clearing, looking like he wanted nothing to do with any of this. Carr Pole barely seemed to notice his presence, and Stike waved him off.
"Go back to camp," he told Jackal. "Tell Ibana that everything is in control here. We'll be back soon."
The words were barely out of his mouth when Jackal took off into the darkness.
"Will he be attacked leaving the camp?" Stike asked Carr Pole.
"No,"
she answered through the mouth of the commander.
"Do you have control of the whole camp?" he asked.
"Not exactly," Carr Pole said. "I have about a third of them. Enough to remain unmolested."
Stike walked around the commander once more, then over to Carr Pole. Despite her smugness, he could see she was uneasy. He wondered how much practice she had being close up and personal with the people she controlled.
"We didn't find this camp until almost light this morning,"
he said in answer to her earlier question.
"I didn't know you had things under control, so I didn't want to risk coming during the day."
Carr Pole pursed her lips, nodding as if this were a satisfactory explanation.
"I'm almost done here. We can go soon."
Stike faced her, leaning over her until their faces were inches apart.
"I want to know why you're here."
"Answers,"
she replied shortly. She was unintimidated by his size, returning his look coolly. Stike reminded himself that he was just as unintimidated by her sorcery. Disconcerted by it, yes, but it did not scare him, and he wanted her to know that.
"What kind of answers?"
That uncertainty that he had seen in her eyes suddenly came to the forefront. She scowled distractedly into the darkness.
"The kind that I cannot get from anyone else but a Dionysus officer," she said.
"Such as?"
Carr Pole did not answer. She sighed heavily, and Stike left her to stand in front of the commander.
"Is she still in there?"
he asked. Yes, she is. They all are, to different degrees.
I want to talk to her.
Carpel's eyebrows rose. She shrugged, and a sheen of sweat suddenly sprang to the face of the Dionysus commander, her eyes widening further, face tensing.
What do you want?
She snarled in Dionysus. This, Stike realized, was her real voice.
Who are you? Stike asked in Palo.
He repeated the question slowly to make sure she understood. The sweating grew more severe. He wondered if she was struggling against Carpole's hold on her, and if it was possible to break it.
Can you force her to answer?
He asked Carpole, forestalling the answer by holding up a hand to Carpole and speaking to the officer directly.
No, wait. I don't give a shit who you are. Tell me why you're after me. Didn't Kar said you'll think the dragon men were enough?
Dragon men?
The commander echoed.
The ones who've been following me. They're not with you?
The commander let out a hissing breath.
They're after you. If I'd known that, I wouldn't have bothered. What do you mean? What do you know of them? All I know is that 6 disgraced dragon men were freed by Carcedule after landfall fell. They were given the task of assassinating a Fatrastan officer in order to redeem themselves in the eyes of the Emperor. That's all I was told.
So, if you're not with them, who are you?
The sweating intensified again, her eyes flicking from Stike's face to Carpole and back again.
My name is Lynn Merce, she said in a low voice, and I'm here because you killed my sister.
You weren't commanded to come after me.
No, I took my command and deserted the army.
Stike paused. Over the years he'd had plenty of people come after him for revenge. He was, after all, a fairly prolific killer. But he'd never had someone abandon their post for the express purpose of vengeance.
And the consequences?
He asked.
I can never go home.
The voice came out in a whisper. Lynn Merce stared into Stike's eyes with more hatred than he'd ever seen in a human being, and he was suddenly struck by a rare moment of real compassion. She had given up everything for her vengeance. She had ambushed him. She had crossed swords with him. She'd even managed to outsmart him more than once over the last few weeks. Without Carpole's interference, she might have bounced back and still managed to kill Stike. He could see in her eyes that she knew she was dead. She knew the power Abonai was capable of, and she clearly knew by now that Carpole was something special.
But that hate was still there.
Her whole body trembled as she fought for even a fraction of control so that she could strike at the man who'd taken her sister. He wondered if he would feel the same about his own.
When did I kill her?
He asked.
She was with the cavalry you fought north of Landfall.
When you first landed?
No, after your general fled the city. I was told you ran her down, trampling her beneath the feet of your horse like a dog.
Stike recalled that battle quite well. Windy River, Flint's men had called it afterward. The Mad Lancers had attempted a flanking move, only to run into a superior force doing the same thing. The battle had been brutal, but the Lancers had prevailed.
In battle, Stike said thoughtfully, we're all dogs.
She was everything to me,
Lynn Merce whispered. Stike gave a heavy sigh, walking around Lynn Merce and letting his eyes run over the lines of men sitting obediently under the thrall of Carpole's sorcery. In another life, Lynn Merce might be him. These men might be Mad Lancers, and Carpole might be on the Dionysus side.
I have more to ask her.
The voice came from Lynn Merce's mouth, but it belonged to Carpole.
Every moment she lives is agony, Stike replied. She doesn't deserve that.
I don't care.
I do.
Stike stepped swiftly up behind Lynmerse and took a solid grip on her hair.
You're the only cavalry commander who's ever gotten the best of me, he said in her ear, before drawing his boss knife across her throat.
He pulled, going deep, the metal rasping along her spine, and he held her body as the blood soaked them both, until well after she stopped convulsing. Finally, he lowered her to the ground. He knelt next to the corpse for a few moments before looking up at Carpole.
Oh, stop glaring at me, he told her. You're like a goddamn child playing with ants compared to these. Either let them go, or let me kill them.
The glaring continued, and Stike stepped over the corpse and approached Carpole.
I know exactly what kind of a monster I am, but I don't approve of suffering. You can find your answers from someone else. She earned herself a quick death.
He turned away, then thought better of it and swung back around to face Carpole.
If you have this kind of power, you should be using it to keep my men alive. You should strike first, not wait until we've taken such a damn battering. Figure out what you are and be it, but don't toy with people beneath you, and don't waste the lives of my lancers.
He gave her one last long look, and then headed back to camp.
Chapter 49
Mikkel was unable to stop thinking about how Yggdrasia had the softest, most comfortable sheets he'd ever touched in his life. He lay in her bed, staring at the ceiling, watching the late morning light slowly inch across, while he tried to focus on the Black Hats. Where was Jatura hiding? How had he arrested so many blackouts without a single soul knowing where to find that asshole? How did Jatura keep conducting these bombings? The questions kept running through his head, but he kept coming back to Yggdrasia's sheets. She said they were some sort of rare silk from Dionysus. Mikkel had slept on silk sheets once or twice, and he didn't remember them feeling anything like this. Even when he rubbed them between his fingers, it was like touching gossamer, ethereal, lacking any kind of substance. Like sleeping on the steam from a kettle in that split second after it had cooled enough to touch, but before it had evaporated. He glanced over at Yggdrasia. She apparently had no problem sleeping until noon. She was still snoring softly, her face looking peaceful and pleased, in that way of a child dreaming of something nice. She was, he decided, a genuinely pleasant person who happened to be a privileged. Maybe not a good person. She spoke of killing and torture with the offhand manner of someone who is well acquainted with both. But she was quietly charming in a way that almost made Mikkel forget about the pair of ruined gloves in her breast pocket or next to the bed. Mikkel slipped out of bed and headed to the window to watch the afternoon traffic.
You're letting yourself get distracted because you can't find the girl,
he muttered to himself, glancing over his shoulder at Yggdrasia's sleeping form.
I'm protecting myself, he answered. And done well enjoying it in the meantime. I can mix work and play, he insisted under his breath. I've done it before. Not when there was this much on the line. You went off the road the moment you decided that punching Fogula in public was a good idea. You've become too exposed here, too known.
Mikkel sucked on his teeth, trying to come up with a rebuttal to his own accusations. Nothing came to mind. Back when he worked his way up through the Black Hats as an informant, he'd gone deep into enemy territory by joining separatist movements and rubbing shoulders with propagandists and gangs. He'd never infiltrated a damned government.
Yes, you have.
He laughed at himself quietly.
You're confusing Black Hat Mikkel with real Mikkel again. Your whole damn life is an infiltration.
Do you think that the Dianites are any more dangerous than the Black Hats?
He briefly considered Taniel's warnings about the Bone Eyes, but his thoughts were broken by a soft moan behind him. He turned to find Ictresia stretching languidly, giving him that cat-in-a-sunbeam smile that she seemed to use so often.
"What are you muttering about over there?"
she asked. "Work," he answered truthfully. He continued, "I'm trying to figure out where Jatura has gone."
"You're very focused."
"It's my job. I'm not allowed to not think about these things." Ictresia sat up, the sheets pooling around her stomach. She reached into the drawer of her nightstand and produced a marla pipe, lighting it expertly with a match and taking a long drag before holding it toward him. "This early in the day?" he asked. She let smoke curl out of her nostrils.
"One advantage to being a tool of the state is that I don't think about work. Once in a while I'm pointed at something that needs to be destroyed, or people who need to die, and,
She made a poof gesture with one hand, then took another drag of the mala and set the pipe aside. Her tone was careless, but Mikkel thought he saw a tightness in the corner of her eyes.
"I'm taking your advice to heart," Mikkel said. "I'm going to ignore Sedil and focus on making myself useful to your government."
"Our government," Ictresia corrected. "Or have you already forgotten your place, Devon Mikkel?"
"Our government," Mikkel agreed. "Sorry, it takes some getting used to."
Ictresia watched him with a soft smile, eyes half-lidded. And for a moment Mikkel harboured a fear that she could see through him into his secrets, that she'd caught all his tiny verbal mistakes and considered ulterior motives, and already suspected him of being something more than either a black hat or a turncoat. Ictresia patted the bed beside her, and Mikkel took two involuntary steps forward before his ears caught the sound of a carriage coming to a stop in front of the townhouse. He backpedaled to the window and looked down to find a carriage with the red and black curtains of a Dionysian dignitary. There were a dozen soldiers on horseback surrounding the carriage, and it didn't take long for Mikkel to find out why. A footman opened the door, and Kaa Sedil stepped out, knuckling his back while the footman ran to Ictresia's door.
"Kaa Sedil is here,"
Mikkel warned, just 2 seconds before there was a hammering down below them. Shit! Ictresia stashed the marla pipe and leapt from bed, snatching a silk robe from the floor. She threw it over her shoulders as she joined him at the window, looking down on her grandfather. And Mikkel was surprised to hear real venom in her voice.
"I sent the damn servants away so I could enjoy you."
The pounding continued, and she swore again.
"Stay here, and don't you dare get dressed."
Barefoot, and in just a robe, Ictresia ran from the room. Mikkel listened to her footsteps down the hall and then the stairs. A moment later, he heard the door open underneath the bedroom. He pressed himself against the wall, watching the group in the street outside. Sedil's bodyguard remained in their saddles while the footman returned to Sedil and gave a half bow. Sedil seemed to hesitate, and Mikkel couldn't help but think that if he had a rifle in hand, he could do more damage to the Dionysus with a single bullet from this angle than all the work he could possibly do for Taniel for the rest of his life. To his surprise, a second carriage pulled up behind Kaa Sedil's. There were no bodyguards, but Sedil gestured to the carriage as if it was expected. A paler woman emerged, perhaps 19 or 20, and joined Sedil in the street. Taking her arm, cane in the other hand, Sedil walked toward Ictresia's door. Curious, Mikkel slipped on his pants and crept into the hallway, eyeballing the distance between the joists beneath the floorboards in an effort to avoid the creakiest parts of the floor. He could hear Sedil and Ictrasia speaking. But it wasn't until he was nearly at the top of the stairs that he could hear their conversation well. They spoke in quick-fire Dionyse, making it a little hard for Mikkel to follow.
"Not to come here yourself. If you want me, send someone for me," Ictrasia was saying.
Sedil's voice was a little quieter, but there was a tone of irritated dismissal in his tone that sounded nothing like his public persona.
"I'll visit you whenever I want. Are you worried I'll walk in on you with whatever slut you're riding lately?"
Mikkel nearly gasped at the strength of the language. He couldn't imagine anyone speaking that way to a privileged. Sedil continued.
"There's no one here now, is there?"
"No. There's no one here,"
Ictrasia spat at her grandfather. "You're the one that's brought a stranger into my home. Who is this?" Mikkel heard someone pacing. It was too slow and deliberate to be Ictrasia, and the sudden rap of a cane punctuated the footsteps.
"I'm hearing rumours, Ictrasia, that you've taken in that black hat spy. I'll give you one chance to deny them, and all will be forgiven."
"Forgiven?" Ictrasia mocked. "You have absolutely no say over who I take into my bed."
"I do when they're enemy spies."
"He is a member of Yarit's household."
"Even worse."
Ictrasia continued as if Sedil hadn't interjected.
"He's handed most of the city's black hats over to us in a matter of weeks."
"He forced one of my people to commit suicide in public. Fogula was valuable to me."
Ictrasia barked a laugh, and Mikkel briefly entertained himself by imagining Sedil's face at being mocked openly.
"You're pissed because he outmaneuvered her. Fogula was a bitch, and it was cathartic to finally see her get her dues."
Ictrasia paused briefly, lowering her voice.
"You were using enemies of the state to destroy your enemies within the state. You would execute anyone else for trying to do the same."
"My enemies weaken the state,"
Sedil growled, rapping the floor again with his cane.
"Clumsy, foolish ministers like Yarit slow down our progress here."
"Ministers like Yarit keep the state together."
"I am the state."
Mikkel was once again surprised to hear something like that so boldly stated, but he'd begun to get the impression that this conversation was a continuation of many more just like it. He heard Ictrasia give an angry sigh.
"You're an old man hoping to leave a legacy of something other than blood before death finally claims you."
"You speak as if a legacy of blood is a bad one."
There was a long silence, and Sedil continued in a softer tone.
"I didn't come here to fight."
"Then what did you come for?" Ictrasia demanded.
"I came to tell you that you're needed down south. We have every privileged in the city working on the stone, and they've made very little progress. Your help is sorely needed."
Mikkel shifted a half-step closer to the stairs, listening carefully as the voices lost some of their heat. Ictrasia replied to her grandfather after a moment's hesitation.
"I've told you before, I will not go near that thing."
"Even if I give you an order?"
"You are not the Emperor, and the Emperor made it very clear that I would not be forced to touch the Godstone unless it was absolutely vital."
"It is vital."
There was another long pause, and Ictrasia laughed again. It was a bitter, venom-filled sound.
"You can't undo what she did, can you?"
Sedil did not answer, so she continued.
"You have no idea how delicious that is," she said.
"Watch your tongue."
"Or what? You'll pack me off to be tortured, I know what pain is, you old lizard. I've had to stand next to you for more than 10 minutes at a time, haven't I?
Mikel lay his head against the wall, eyes wide, wondering if Ictrasia had gotten so angry that she forgot Mikel was up here. Surely she had to know he'd be listening. Even if he stayed in a room, he would have heard some of this. Sediel took a measured breath and finally responded.
We will undo her sabotage. It'll take time, admittedly, but she is not as powerful as she thinks. Her sorcery is fumbling and amateurish, and when I catch her, I will teach her exactly what a bone eye is capable of.
Good luck with that. Ictrasia's tone told Mikel that she was wishing Sediel anything but luck. Another measured breath, taken with the long-suffering air of a man enduring untold dignity.
It doesn't have to be like this, Sediel said.
Doesn't it?
No. You know I love you. You know I'd do anything for my Mawa.
Mikel felt every muscle in his body tense at the name. His breathing came short, and he tried to think. It was a name, he was certain. Wasn't it? A pet name? A reference to something else? It was the first time he'd heard the word used in any way in the Dianai's language, and he wondered if perhaps he had just misheard a similar word. Sediel continued.
I brought you a present, just like I did when you were a little girl.
Ictrasia snorted, and Mikel suddenly remembered the beautiful young woman still standing down there in the room with them.
What is she, a slave?
Slave? No, we don't have slaves in the Empire anymore.
Then why would she be here by her own will? Surely she's figuring out right about now that you wouldn't allow her to live after listening to a conversation like this. Unless she's one of your spies, of course.
Oh, come now. I didn't purchase her. I purchased the enormous debt that she owes some very bad people down in Greenfire Depths. She has agreed to be your plaything for as long as you want her around. After which you may send her back to the depths, or set her free, or whatever you please. She is just your type, isn't she?
You think I want a plaything?
How old do you think I am? You always want a plaything. You've gone through dozens over the last few years. This one isn't allowed to talk back to you. I thought you'd find that quite satisfactory.
What's the catch?
Ictrasia sounded like she was considering this offer, and Mikel couldn't quite suppress his horror.
Must there be a catch?
I know you better than anyone, you old lizard.
Sediel gave the amused harumph of an elderly relative dealing with a difficult child.
Get rid of the black hat. Keep this girl as a gift, and I won't force you to go to help with the Godstone.
There was another long pause, this one nearly a minute, and Mikel could hear someone walking around. He imagined Ictrasia doing a circuit around the offered woman, examining her like a man might examine a new horse. Ictrasia sniffed.
Do you want me to kill him?
Mikel's blood ran cold.
I should make you do it yourself for being such a petulant little bitch. But no. Send him back to Yarit. I'll deal with him myself in time. But until then, I don't need you mocking me by parading him around on your arm at the clubs and games.
I'll consider it.
You'll take it.
Until you are my emperor, may all the heavens prevent that from ever happening, I will not follow your orders. I will consider this offer of yours.
Give me an answer soon.
Leave the girl.
Mikel imagined the two staring angrily at each other until Sedil suddenly rapped on the floor twice with his cane and left through the front door, with a stride that seemed far too strong for a man of his age. Mikel waited for just a moment before turning to creep back toward the room. He was stopped by the sound of a sigh.
"Can you talk?"
he heard Ictrasia ask. A frightened voice answered in Palo.
"Yes, Mum." "Is what he said true? Did he buy your debt?" "Yes, Mum."
"That goddamn pig. Don't flinch away. I'm not going to take you to bed or kill you.
Do you know where the army camps are to the west of the city?" "I do, Mum."
"Take this note to the guards at the camp of the Falcon 3rd Regiment. There is a man there named Devin Catherton, who I trust. He'll give you a job. Nothing you don't want to do, hear me? Go directly there, and don't use any of the carriages in the city, and don't go back to Sedil. I suggest you change your name and forget your friends and family if you don't want to end up dead. You can leave by the back door." "Go!" Footsteps fled down the hallway beneath Mikel, and he heard the back door open and close. In the sitting room below him, Ictrasia dropped into a chair with a sigh. He slowly backed away from the stairs, heading back to the bedroom, where he found his shirt and boots and quickly began getting dressed. He wanted to ask Ictrasia a thousand questions, but two burning bits of information kept his heart racing in a near panic. Would she put him out to please her grandfather? And was she this Mara person whom he'd been looking for this whole time? He finished lacing his boots and looked up, only to find Ictrasia standing in the doorway with one arm up on the door, her robe open, another hand on her hip. Her eyes were puffy and red, her mouth turned down at the corners. Mikel got to his feet and took a step toward her nightstand, with the privileged gloves sitting on them, wondering if she'd come up here to take her anger out on him.
"How much did you overhear?"
"Some," Mikel said, as innocuously as possible. "It was quite loud." Ictrasia sniffed.
"You were eavesdropping."
She walked past him quickly, but instead of her gloves, she retrieved her marler pipe and flung it at the far wall. It shattered, sending bits of glass, ash, and marler across the room.
"You're a damn spy. If you weren't listening from the top of the stairs, I would think less of you."
"Well, out with it. What do you want to ask? Am I going to turn you inside out and hand you to Sedil?" She scoffed and crossed to the window, where she glared out into the street as if to be sure Sedil was gone. "Do you want to ask why I hate him? Come, I can see the damn question on your lips." Mikel tried to work some moisture back into his mouth.
"Who is Mara?"
"What?" Ictrasia blinked at him, looking genuinely confused. Perhaps he had misheard the word. His inexperience with the language had defeated him, and now he'd asked a question that could arouse her suspicion.
"Too damn late now."
"Who is Mara?" he asked again.
"I heard Sedil say the name."
Ictrasia still seemed baffled. This was certainly not the question she'd expected him to voice.
"It's not a name."
Mikel's mind began to turn faster, trying to fit pieces into place in the hope that this new information might help him find Taniel's informant. Until Ictrasia continued,
"Well, it's not exactly a name. I'm Mara. It's an old word, a pet name that Sedil has used for me since I was a little girl."
Mikel began to pace immediately, the near panic of earlier blowing into a full panic now. She was Mara, the goddamn nickname of a privileged, and Taniel hadn't thought that either of those bits of information were important. Did he think that leaving out the privileged bit was the only way to convince Mikkel to take the job? That otherwise Mikkel would have gotten out of the city as fast as his feet could carry him? Because he was damn well right.
"Why do you want to know about that name?" Yggdrasil asked, taking a step toward him.
Mikkel took the same step back, edging toward the door. He'd spent 3 days with her now, and he suddenly didn't recognize her any more. It terrified him almost as much as those gloves sitting on the nightstand.
"I have to go."
"What? No!
Answer my question."
Mikkel glanced at the gloves, then at Yggdrasil's face.
"Yarret needs me right now," he said with more confidence than he felt, heading for the front door.
Chapter 50. It took a day to set up the duel. Laura stayed in a back room of Bert's brothel, nursing the cuts on her hands and only leaving once to send a secure courier to Olam with instructions to inch the army closer to Yellow Creek. The morning brought a cold wind sweeping down from the mountains, chilling Flora through her clothes as she stepped outside with an entourage that included Bert and 50 of his armed posse. Most of them were palo, but more than a few were Cressian or girlish. The sun wasn't even above the trees yet, and traffic was sparse. Children lined the rooftops watching them pass, and Flora guessed that word about this duel had spread. They walked down the main road, passing the hotel where Flora had spent the first week of her stay. The fidgety manager stood on the stoop, eyes glued to the procession. They kept onward, finally turning off the street and entering a dusty park, where a public gallows stood ominously creaking in the wind. The corner of the park was full of tombstones. Men and women lined the other side of the park, all of them similarly well armed, and they outnumbered Bert's people by at least a dozen. Nohan stood at the centre of the group beside a dark-skinned Deliv woman in a corseted crimson dress. She was dressed more like a courtesan at a dinner party than someone out early in the morning to watch two people fight to the death. Flora leaned over to Bert.
"Is that Jessie in the red dress?" she asked.
"That's her."
Bert puffed on a cigar. He wore a dashing brown suit, complete with cane and bowler cap, and he too seemed to be treating this as a matter of entertainment rather than dire consequence.
"Does she know what I am?"
Bert grinned around his cigar.
"She has no idea. She bet her best gold mine against 7 of my smaller claims without batting an eye. Either she knows something I don't, or she doesn't know that I know her man is a mage."
He looked skyward, as if making sure the order of the sentence sounded right, then nodded to himself. "Whoever wins, this is going to be a lot more interesting than she expects." So Bert was betting against the house. It didn't surprise Flora, not much, but she was slightly annoyed at how cavalier he was about this thing. He might lose a handful of small claims, but she could be dead in 10 minutes. Flora eyed the armed men.
"Is this going to turn into a battle?"
"It shouldn't. The deputies are steering clear this morning, but nobody wants a real confrontation. This is just a bit of fun."
"And all the weapons?"
"Precaution."
Flora eyed Noan. He didn't look great. He still limped from their tussle, and his arms seemed stiff. He didn't look like he'd gotten much more sleep than she had. Probably he'd been out hunting her each of the last few nights. She had little question that he was running a damned powerful powder trance. Flora was confident, but she knew that being too confident could get her killed. This was a trained powder mage who delighted in killing. He was bigger, stronger, and just as fast. Even if she won, she was unlikely to leave this fight unscathed. She tested the tightness of the stitches Bert's surgeon had redone on her arms, knowing that she'd probably rip them all out. Taking a powder charge between her fingers, she crushed the paper and reached up her sleeve to rub the powder beneath her bandage, feeling the fire as it reached her bloodstream. She took another charge and sniffed it, turning away from the others lest Jesse see the act and try to cancel the duel. She had no one out in the open. This had to end now. Bert checked his pocket watch, then twirled it on the end of its chain. "It's time, Mom," he told Flora.
"Agreed."
She and Bert went to the middle of the park, where they were soon joined by Jesse and Noan. Jesse gave them both a toothy, charming smile.
"My friends," she began.
"Can it, Jesse?" Bert replied pleasantly. "This is the woman you tried to have killed when she wouldn't work with you."
Jessie lifted her chin, looking down her nose at Laura.
"Is that so?
The one whose friend killed poor Dorna? Pity that. Dorna was always a loyal dog. Does your champion have a name?"
"Verundish," Laura answered.
"Verundish."
Jessie rolled the name around on her tongue.
"No one says he knows you. Is that true?"
"We have a history."
Jesse's smile broadened.
"I'm glad we're here to let you work out your problems. Do you know what Noan is, little lady? He's a powder mage. You sure you want to fight him?"
Jesse scrunched up her face, wiggling her nose, her eyes smiling.
"Powder mages are all fluff," Flora said, staring at Noan.
The bastard hadn't even warned his boss what he was up against. What a weaseling asshole.
"If you insist," Jesse said. "Now then, Bert, are we agreed on the terms?"
"You're mine, my claims. Straight up bet with Kresimir and all gathered as my witness."
Jesse's eyes flicked up to the armed men Bert had brought with him.
"And no funny business?"
"None coming from me."
Bert puffed on his cigar, then extended his hand. The two shook. He leaned over to Flora.
"Don't make me a poorer man, Lady Flint,"
he whispered. Then he retreated back to the other side of the park. It was the first time he'd outright stated that he knew who she was. Flora tried not to let it bother her, watching as Jesse retreated as well, leaving Flora and Noan alone. She couldn't sense any powder on him, and had left hers with Bert. She wanted to focus on this without having to worry about him trying to detonate her powder, and he'd obviously felt the same.
"Just a couple of powder mages," Flora said, "high as girlish sand riders, with a pair of swords between them. This should be fun, don't you think?"
Noan glared at her. "I'm not here for fun. I'm here to win back my pride."
"Well, I'm not sure you had any to begin with," Flora said, drawing her sword. Her mentor had always taught her to kill in cold blood, to set aside the quips and the insults, and to let her sword talk for her. Flora, however, was not Tamas.
"You're an asshole, Noan. You should have just accepted it and tried to rein in your lust for blood. You would have gotten on a lot farther in life."
"What, working in your damned cabal?"
"You wanted to at one point. Now you're a bitter sword for hire, and you've been coaxed into a duel instead of sitting back and shooting at me from the other side of town. It was a good strategy. You should have stuck to it."
"You sure it was me who walked into a trap?"
Noan demanded. Flora let her eyes travel along the men standing on the other side of the park, then to the rooftops, wondering if perhaps she'd made an error. Was Noan cleverer than she expected? Had he set her up? Or was this a last bit of bravado to throw her off her feet?
"Goodbye, Noan,"
Flora said, stepping forward.
Audible gasps rose from the watchers as the two crossed swords.
Noan leapt to the offensive, driving Flora back with a series of thrusts that were almost too fast for the eye to follow. Laura allowed herself to relax, drawing on instinct to parry and riposte, keeping her footing steady as she backed away. Their blades blurred in the morning sunlight, and dust rose around them from their footwork. She continued to fall back. Letting her opponent tire themselves out was a time-honored dueling strategy, but that wouldn't work on a powder mage, at least not very quickly. But she could let his fury build, keeping him at bay without striking back, and that's what she did as they circled the park. Within moments she could hear mutters, and someone said the words, "Powder mage." Bets were soon being shouted back and forth as the big boss's underlings worked themselves into a frenzy. Flora parried a particularly powerful strike and was immediately forced to duck below a swing and throw herself to one side. Sweat began to pour down her face as she focused harder. No one managed to get inside her guard, nicking her right forearm. She answered by cutting off the tip of his nose, causing him to stumble back amid a flurry of curses. She followed him coldly, suddenly on the attack, moving with purpose. He managed to parry several strikes in a row, but then she was inside his guard. She stabs his right shoulder, parried a riposte, and stabbed him just below the ribs. His sword arm faltered, and she stepped forward and caught him by the front of his jacket, thrusting her sword through his heart until her hilt touched his chest. She held him up, his body twitching, his eyes rolling as he died. After a few moments, she pulled out her sword and let him fall. The cheers, jeers, and bets quieted. The dust slowly settled. Flora turned to Bert, who held his cigar between his teeth with a grin. His cigar was no shorter. The fight had lasted 30 seconds, maybe less. She turned to Jezzy, whose face was ashen, her broad smile gone. Jezzy took 2 steps toward Flora, then stopped, hawking a wad of phlegm at her champion.
"You cheated," Jezzy spat.
The assembled crowd immediately erupted into chaos. Accusations flew from both sides. Bert held his arms up in alarm, shouting, "No!" over and over again, while muskets, blunderbusses, and swords were shaken angrily on all sides. Flora whirled, her head spinning, her thoughts hard to focus after the euphoric adrenaline of the fight.
"Nobody cheated," she said to Jezzy. "Your man lost. Pay up to Bert, or everyone here will see you for a coward."
She turned back to Bert, hoping he'd back her up, when she heard a musket shot. Most people assumed that powder mages were infallible when it came to black powder, that they could stop every powder ignition, and that any bullet that managed to fly would somehow miss them. This was, of course, a myth that Flora had been disabused of from an early age. Any powder mage could be shot. All you had to do was overwhelm them, confuse them, or just take them by surprise. She felt the bullet hit her in the back a fraction of a second after she heard the blast. She stumbled forward, falling to her knees, watching the surprise spread on Bert's face. Bert suddenly leapt for the ground, and the world erupted in violence as both sides opened fire. Bullets whizzed over and around Flora, a soft undertone to the cacophony of powder blasts and men screaming. Flora struggled to open the button on the breast pocket of her jacket, only to remember that there was no powder inside. Her head was fuzzy, her thoughts confused. She felt a burning between her shoulder blades that she could not ignore. All around her, men and women died. Weapons were fired, and it quickly became apparent that both sides had stationed people on the roof. The exchange grew more frenzied and wild, and Flora forced herself to her feet and began to walk. In the chaos and the dust and powder smoke, it was difficult to tell who was shooting at whom. She reached out with her senses toward the armed gang behind her, where Jezzy was being protected by her men, and detonated their powder with a thought. The kickback from touching off over 36 sources of powder at once nearly caused her to pass out, but she pushed on until she fell on her knees beside Bert. Bert seemed unharmed. He held his hands over his head, cigar crushed in the dust and cane lost, as he pressed his face against the ground. She forcibly turned him over, searching his pocket for her spare powder cartridges and shoving them into her own jacket.
"Remember our deal," she growled, regaining her feet.
She detonated the powder of a trio of armed women on a roof across the street, ripping them, and the building on which they stood, in half. The exchange of gunfire continued, and Flora wondered just how many men both sides had brought with them. Her ears ringing, she could make out gunfire from all over, extending well into the streets. Both of these fools had brought their entire private armies with them. She limped away from the park, back the way they'd come down the main street, snorting powder to quell the pain between her shoulders. She assessed the damage. Her chest and the muscles of her back were tight, every step causing a spike of pain to bleed through her powder trance. She could still move her arms, though not as well. It would have to be good enough. The acrid smell of smoke caught her attention, and she knew immediately that it was not powder smoke. There was a fire somewhere behind her, maybe even set by her own detonations, and she thought of all the slapdash wooden buildings crammed in together in the valley. Fire would spread damned fast. She redoubled her efforts. The streets were full of people screaming and running. Flora was jostled and shoved, but otherwise ignored. Some people ran away from the firefight, others called for a bucket brigade and ran toward the flames. She reached Bert's brothel, fetched her pistol from Bert's office, and then went for her horse in his stable. A curious stable boy saddled the animal for a handful of pennies, while Flora rested on a hay bale in the corner. Blood dripped down both arms, and when she finally regained her feet, the hay was crimson. It took the stable boy's help to get her into the saddle. Flora rode out of town, slumped in the saddle, trying to get as far away from the fighting as possible. This wasn't her war. This wasn't why she was here. She drifted in and out of consciousness, barely holding together enough to direct her horse up the road leading to Little Flering's compound.
"What the pit is going on?"
Little Flering demanded from her vantage point above her cabin. Laura tried to answer as she attempted to dismount, and only managed to slip from the saddle and fall to the ground in a heap. The last thing she remembered was hands lifting her toward the sky. Chapter 51 The Mad Lancers left the Hog and the remnants of their dragoon rivals and soon reached the coast. They skirted the city fortress of New Starlight late in the evening, using a sunken road to slip by undetected. It wasn't until they were well past that Stike allowed himself to circle around the end of his army and gaze back upon the city, squinting through the fading light at Dionysus' flags flying from the turrets that had once flown the flag of the Phytrastan army. The city fortress was not like anything else in Phytrasta. It was built on a wedge of land jutting off the northwest edge of the Hammer, and guarded by a sloped curtain wall that cut the entire wedge off from the mainland and housed a small city. Enough space for around 10,000 people. Inside that was the fortress itself, a towering knife of white stone, freckled with red, surrounded by 7 mighty turrets, the largest of which was topped with an enormous lighthouse to warn incoming ships of the rocks below.
"Is that a castle?"
Stike turned to find Celine beside him, gently patting Margot on the neck. He sized up New Starlight, realizing that it looked far more like a storybook castle than it did the palisades or star forts that dotted Phytrasta.
"I suppose it is," he said.
It wasn't a pretty castle, not by a long shot, but it had all the trappings of one.
Who built it?
A Starlish Duke, he told Selene. He was one of the first Ceres explorers to cross through the heart of Vetrasta, and when he reached here, he enslaved the local Palo and made them build him this fortress. I think this was 300 years ago.
Selene's eyes widened.
It's stood that long?
There are older castles in the Nine, but it's a decent enough fortress.
He pointed to the turrets.
Those are big enough to hold modern cannons, and the wall is sloped slightly, which helps take a pounding from straight shot.
Then why do the Dynais hold it?
She asked.
There's no sign of a battle.
Stike frowned at the fortress. She was right. There were no signs of a battle. The walls were undamaged, all of the turrets standing.
Sharp eyes.
He pondered the question for a few moments.
The garrison must have abandoned it at the first sight of the enemy. Maybe when they heard about landfall. Damn cowards.
He resisted the urge to take a closer look. Even a poor garrison could have held New Starlight against an enemy siege. Those towers would make short work of just about any fleet attempting a blockade. But New Starlight wasn't his problem. As they watched, a small, mounted force exited the curtain wall and rode east. Definitely Dionysus soldiers. Stike remained until the sun was almost gone, searching the horizon for any signs of those dragonmen, before turning Amrek to catch up with the Mad Lancers. Selene followed in his wake. Their camp was a few miles south of New Starlight, in a gentle valley large enough to hold most of their army, but small enough for a scout to miss until they were right on top of it. As Stike and Selene rode in, the men were just beginning to set up their tents, and Stike proceeded to the other side of the camp where he found Ibana, Karpol, Gustar, and a dozen Mad Lancers gathered around an opening in the hillside. The opening had, until a few minutes ago, been hidden behind a boulder. The entrance was squat, no more than 3 feet by 3 feet, and held together by thick-cut timbers. It looked like the entrance to a tiny mine. Stike handed Amrek off to a nearby soldier and joined Ibana.
"Is it still intact?"
he asked.
"We're finding out," she answered, without looking away from the entrance.
Gustav knelt by the timbers, squinting into the dark hole, a half-smile on his face.
"A black-hat cache, buried under a hill in the middle of nowhere."
He shook his head.
"How many people even know about this?"
5 or 10, Stike said, kneeling next to Gustav and peering into the darkness. He could see a light somewhere in the depths, bobbing around.
"Lindit uses forced labor for this kind of thing, so that word won't get out to the general public." "What's it for?"
Gustav asked.
"This,"
Stike grunted with a gesture toward their camp.
"Lindit is a firm believer in being ready for anything. In addition to regular supplier depots, she's got these caches hidden away all over the country, mostly in the less populated areas. They're specifically meant to resupply an army. If this one is untouched, it'll provide us with canned food, wine, ammunition, and spare weapons to last weeks."
As if to answer the next unspoken question, the bobbing of the light suddenly came toward them, growing until the lantern was set aside, and Jackal's head and shoulders emerged from the pit. Jackal grinned up at them.
"Everything is here," he reported.
Ibana clapped her hands together. Stike couldn't blame her. They needed a bit of good luck after the last couple of weeks of hard riding and fighting.
"Check the tins and barrels," Ibana ordered. "If the rats haven't gotten to any of it, give everyone a double ration of food and wine tonight."
"No drunks," Stike added.
"No drunks," Ibana agreed.
Stike got out of the way to let them work, and soon Jackal was overseeing a chain of men rolling out barrels and handing up crates to empty the deep cache. He watched them work for a few minutes, feeling suddenly tired from the events of the last few weeks. His body reminded him that he was no longer the Mad Ben Stike who could go a week without sleep and still fight